Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, it's a Batman spoiler special with director Matt Reeves. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. And yes, this is a deep dive with the filmmaker behind the movie that everyone is talking about. The Batman is in theaters. And if you're listening to this and you have not seen The Batman, this might not be the podcast for you. Come back when you've seen it, because for the next 45 minutes, it's going to be me and Matt Reeves, and I'm going to be asking the questions that I wanted to ask as I was watching the movie, the ones that have been percolating in my mind ever since I first saw the movie. I got a chance to see it pretty early on, actually, over a month ago, and then I got a chance to see it again just a couple days ago. And there was a lot of outstanding issues I wanted to bring up with Matt, and he was kind enough to go wherever I wanted. And there's some really fascinating stuff in here. I've given you the spoiler warning, right? So now we're cool, right? For me to talk spoilers? Okay, that was it. You got your spoiler warning. Leave now. Okay, we're talking spoilers. So yes, in this podcast, among other things, we do talk about what's already been reported elsewhere, but I don't think in the kind of detail that Matt went in with me on this, of the appearance of the character that turns into the Joker in these in this mythology, in this creation of Matt's, in this interpretation, I should say. The character played by Barry Keoghan talks very much at length about the scene that was deleted from the film, about the makeup, about his function in the story. That is fascinating. There's some really cool stuff towards the end of this conversation about the spin-offs that Matt has been contemplating, including one that seems to be off the table, but he goes into detail about what it would have been. He talks about, I bring up Robin. Could Robin appear in Matt Reeves' very dark interpretation of the Batverse, as he likes to call it? That and more in this spoiler special. Plus, there's just like really cool deep dive, like thematic conversation here. Matt is a deep thinker, a smart, smart filmmaker who I've been on the bandwagon for so, so long. I met him first, when he was promoting Let Me In. I'd of course seen Cloverfield, but Let Me In was the first time we started chatting, and ever since then I've covered all of his films, the two Apes films, and now this Batman film. And he is, he's got a lot to say. Some of the answers are very long, but that's great. I mean, he just goes into such detail with such passion, knows filmmaking inside and out. And I'm so thrilled that we get another brilliant filmmaker to take a crack at Batman. This is one of those characters that can withstand different interpretations, whether it's Tim Burton or Joel Schumacher or Zack Snyder or Christopher Nolan. Now Matt Reeves has his turn to take on The Dark Knight, and he finds some new ways in, as you've seen by now. This is a full-on detective story. It's more Chinatown than a comic book movie, and I really enjoyed it. I was really, really excited by what I saw, and excited for what the future could be for future Batman films, future spin-off movies or TV shows. There's a lot of interesting territory to mine, and I hope Matt sticks with it. It certainly seems like he wants to. And as I tape this, the early box office numbers seem to indicate he may very well get a chance to return to his Batverse. So that is very cool. Okay, before we get to the main event, just a couple housekeeping things. I do want to mention, if you're listening to this before March 10th, or even on the date of March 10th, we have a new Happy, Sad, Confused live event that is taping in New York City the evening of March 10th. 7 p.m., we're going to have a screening of The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray, which is the new Apple TV Plus series starring Samuel L. Jackson, followed by a live one-hour conversation I'll be having with the legend that is Samuel L. Jackson at the 92nd Street Y. So you can buy tickets right now. If you're in New York City, if you're close by, come on out, see a screening, an early screening of the show, and then enjoy me and Sam mixing it up for an hour. We're going to take audience questions. It's going to be a blast. He's one of the best interviews out there. Super candid and just the coolest man on the planet. If you can't get there in person, there are virtual tickets available. You can watch it live from the safety and comfort of your own home. I'll put the link, of course, in the show notes. But, you know, we had so much fun the other day with Sam Heughan. This one's going to be a different kind of vibe, but just as cool and exciting. Sam Jackson and me, March 10th, New York City. You're not going to find a better evening's entertainment than that, guys. Come on. If you're not sick of Batman talk, I had a conversation with Robert Pattinson and Zoe Kravitz. That is on MTV News's YouTube page. Look up, I put it out on my social media on Instagram and Twitter. There's a ton of Outlander stuff I've been doing, guys, whether it's the Sam Heughan 92nd Street Y event, whether it's me surprising Sam in London, a Katrina Balfe interview. That's all up on the Patreon page. Give it a try. As always, tons of extras on Patreon, video versions of the podcast whenever possible, and that's very often possible. Go to patreon.com/happy-sad-confused. You will not be disappointed. Okay, this is it. This is what I've been so excited to have this conversation with Matt ever since he was announced 5 years ago. Like 5 years ago, it's crazy that it took this long, but we got here. The Batman is out. You've seen it by now. Now it's time to get into spoilers. Me and Matt Reeves, please enjoy. Matt Reeves is back on, the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast. He's a regular. Matt, congratulations, man. You know I'm a longtime admirer of your work, and this is just all my interests coming together. I hope you're feeling proud of what you've achieved here, man.
Well, thanks, man. It's good to talk to you again. Yeah, it's a weird moment. You know, it took a long time to get here, and it's finally out in the world. It's very surreal.
I mean, you know, just to have some perspective on the thing. I mean, I've been talking to you since Let Me In, the Apes films. I mean, like, take me back to Matt Reeves as a kid. Think about it. Like, you have been at the helm of two Apes films, like one of the quintessential monster movies, and now have the keys to this, maybe the most beloved comic character of all time. It's got to feel nice to sit in your seat right now.
It's very surreal. I don't know that I ever would have thought that would be, you know, the path that I would be on even. It's just kind of incredible. I have to say that I'm very fortunate that the two, well, I guess if you count Cloverfield, the three sort of, you know, franchises that kind of came my way, but certainly with Apes and Batman, that they really are for me the ones that I think I'm most suited to do. You know what I mean? Because I think there are a lot of franchises. I mean, obviously right now, the way that everything's gone, and obviously it's even more extreme with the pandemic, but the movies that you know, make it on the big screen is a very narrow bunch.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I would be, I don't think I would be right for most of them. And so it's really incredibly fortunate that that two that really mean something to me, not only since I was a kid, but also just that provide the opportunity for kind of interesting exploration. I mean, both the Apes story and the Batman story, they're pretty great. So it's I feel really, really lucky.
Well, I mean, I was saying this to your stars the other day. It is, you know, I've loved all manner of Batman films, and the greatest compliment I can give you is that you found your own unique personal path into it. And it's a really special piece of work, man. I saw it for a second time last night. And it is both epic and intimate. It is a full-on detective story. And you've been kind enough to say you're willing to go into some spoiler territory. This is your spoiler warning for everybody here. Hopefully you have seen the film by now. First, take me back to the beginnings of this project, because when you signed on, as I understand it, Ben Affleck was potentially still involved. So I'm curious if this story, did you imagine this story at one time with an older
Batman with someone of Ben's age? Did you have the framework, and would it have worked, and how would it have been different with that kind of Batman?
Well, I imagined the seeds of this story, but it was not, you know, when I was first approached, I was still pretty early in post on War for the Planet of the Apes. And the post on those movies is the most intensive post that you can imagine, because you've made the movie once and then you have to make it again with the animators and make sure that you're getting all of the performances that you got with your actors, but seeing them on these photoreal apes. So that's a very involved process. And they kept trying to, Warner Brothers kept trying to set a meeting. And I was like, do they understand what I'm doing? It's a very busy time. So my understanding was that it was a general meeting. And I kept turning them down and saying, you know, I'm very flattered, but let's get together after I'm finished with post, and that'll be a good time, which will be unfortunately months away. And my agent called me up after I think I turned them down two or three times. And he said, you know, that general meeting. I said, yeah, it's not really not good timing. And he said, and it's also not a general meeting. It's about Batman. And I was like, oh, okay. And I said, so, all right. You know, as I said, the Apes franchise meant something to me since I was a kid. And that's absolutely true for Batman, which actually even predates it, because Batman 66 started the year I was born. And so Adam West was my Batman. And I've just, you know, I'm a lifelong Batman fan, and I certainly have such respect and admiration for the movies that have been done. I mean, I think that those are some of the best comic book movies ever made. I think that it's kind of like, okay, well then I'm not going to just turn that down out of hand, even though I'm busy. So I'll make time for the meeting. They sent me a script, and it was a script that, you know, it made total sense that this is the way that they would want to do it. It was very much kind of a, like an action gauntlet. It was almost like a,
right.
You know, in some way it was kind of almost like a James Bondian kind of thing, but it was like that kind of thing. But the thing about it is, and it was very deeply connected at that point, because of course it was Ben, and it was it was connected to the DCEU. So it started with scenes that involved the characters from, you know, other movies and all of that. And I totally saw why they were doing that movie. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I totally see that movie, but it's not a movie that I would make, because I don't know. You know, the thing about the way I approach everything is that I have to feel like I have a personal way in, because that's what attunes my compass, so that I know that the decisions I'm making are rooted in something. You know, it tells me where the camera goes and how to sort of pitch the emotional tenor of a scene or what the stakes are and all of that. So I have to have that way in. And this, somebody would have made a great movie out of that. And initially that was what Ben wanted to do, but then he was stepping down and it just wasn't for me. So I actually thought the meeting was going to be pretty short. And I thought it was going to be me seeing, which is interesting, exact same situation on the first Apes movie for me. It was like, look, a franchise I love, a world I love, characters I love, but this approach is not necessarily for me. And if you want me, then it's not going to work to do it this way. I'd have to do it another way. And this one had the added complication of, because I was in the middle of post, I couldn't really tell them what my approach would be.
Right.
So I sort of said, look, I think you probably don't want me. Because I can tell you that this is not the script that I would know how to direct. I'm not the right person for this. So you should, you know, you should go on and find somebody else if this is really what you want to do. And that makes total sense. And they said, well, no, we would at least like to know what you would do. And I said, well, to me, I think the things that came to my mind from the beginning was that I knew that I wanted to take Batman as a character and allow that character and his story to be at the center of the narrative in such a way that he had room to evolve, so that he had the arc.
Yes.
You know, because a lot of times what happens is at a certain point, after you have the origin tale, you've got, Bruce Masters himself, and he goes through this terrible trauma, and there've been great versions of that story done. But this, obviously, given that it was Ben and where it was, there was no way that's what they were doing. And I wouldn't have wanted to do that. And I certainly, even after Ben left, didn't want to do an origin tale, but I wanted to do a story in which Batman was not static. I wanted to do something that the story would challenge him at a psychological level and would force him to confront himself and be engaged in some kind of internal struggle that would make the story not just an external struggle between him and some iconic Rogues Gallery character, but that would be a story of revelation for him, because I was interested in making the story about him. And I also felt that it could be very emotional. And I did think that the World's Greatest Detective part of the story was one area that hadn't been really done in the movies. And so I said, you know, I think that's about what I can tell you. And I said, and if you like that, which would be really exciting, I could probably tell you more about what I want to do in about 6 months from now. And so we left the meeting, and it was, you know, everybody was, it was very nice. I have no idea whether or not that was going to sit with them. I figured they needed to think about that because they had a movie that they were ready to go forward with. And I got a call the next day saying, yeah, they want to wait for you. And I was like, oh, wow. And then I just put my head down and finished War for the Planet of the Apes. So it was a very strange thing. So then during that time, Ben started reevaluating his whole life, what he wanted to do, whether or not he wanted to be playing this character in this way, whether or not he wanted to do this movie. And by the time I had finished Apes, there was a transition where I had, you know, the opportunity to do something different. And then those were still things I wanted to do. That's what,
yeah.
My first instincts are almost always the thing that is the seed of something that I feel is a path. You know, like when an idea comes to you and it feels like something to follow, you kind of try to follow it. And so I then thought, well, gee, and that's when I pressed upon them. I said, obviously now, if Ben is not wanting to do this, I would love to do one that isn't connected at all. Oh, that was, I'm sorry. There was one other caveat I said. I said, the other thing is that a Batman movie, I think a standalone Batman movie, given the history of Batman and the Batman movies, is a high enough bar that I also was adamant that if I were to come on, that though it would be part of the DCEU, I didn't want to service any of that in the movie. I didn't want any of the other characters to appear. I didn't want references to them. I just figured it was enough to do Batman and Gotham. And that world was tough enough and rich enough to be able to try and, it just felt like, okay, look, there's so much to do. The idea that I could serve more than just that idea, that's also something I didn't feel I could do.
Right.
And so anyway, when they said the next day that that they would wait for me, I knew that they were okay with that idea. But then when Ben departed, I knew there was a chance to do something that was literally not connected to the DCU. And then I said to them, look, here's what I'd like to do. And obviously, since, you know, it's not going to be Ben, now we have to recast. And because we're going to recast, my feeling is I'd love to, in the search of trying to find that arc for Batman, I wouldn't do an origin story, which obviously we wouldn't have done. But I do think that there's something about the idea of an early years Batman and the idea of that character not being fully cognizant of all of the motivations that are driving him. He's almost like he's compelled and sort of addicted to this thing. So he wouldn't have been the disillusioned Batman that I think that Ben would have played for sure. He would be a character lacking in kind of self-knowledge, a younger Batman. And they said, okay. And so I went off and started, I said, you know, and it's going to be like a detective story. It's going to be, I'm going to give you the Batmobile chase. I'm going to give you all that stuff.
Right.
But it's going to be like Chinatown. Like I'm going to try and figure out to do that kind of thing. And, you know, there's so many times throughout the course of making this film, all the way back to the script stage, where I kept thinking, is this suicide? Is this crazy? And yet part of me was like, but this is the thing. You can't come to a Batman movie and not feel like you have, first of all, you have to have your own personal way in, because otherwise you're not going to have a compass. But also you have to feel like you're doing something different, because there's been so many great. So what justifies, especially if you're going to do a new standalone, what justifies restarting this character, you know, with new, you know, actors, new versions of all this, a new Gotham? And for me, it really was the opportunity to do this kind of detective story, but I wanted a detective story that was also character oriented. So in that way, Chinatown was a good model, because Jake Giddies has this backstory that you never see, but you know that something happened to him in Chinatown. And it really made him the person he is today, which is that he's like an ambulance chaser now. He's trying to convince himself that he's just this slick, callow, you know, opportunist. But under it all, there's some pull there that something happened. And over the course of that movie, you see all of that bubbling back up. And so the story, without ever going back to the origins directly, becomes quite personal for him. And then by the end, it becomes this big sort of, you know, personally tragic story, really. And so I was like, well, that's what I want, is I want to make sure that we're not just doing a detective story and he's following the clues and solving it. I want him to do that part of it. But I wanted it to be one where the journey itself was going to become unexpectedly personal.
Yes.
And that to me was really important.
What's the first scene that you wrote, and does it remain in the film?
Well, I always do everything chronologically. So the first thing I wrote was the opening. Yeah, it's exactly. And I wrote that exactly as it is. I wrote, you know, one of the things I do when I'm writing is I try to write, I often write a very large number of the shots that you see in the film. They're written on the page, because what I'm trying to do is find the movie. And so I start trying to, from the beginning, search for things that make it feel like I'm making the movie on paper. And then we make the movie in prep, and then we make the movie, and then we remake the movie again in post. And so, you know, a lot of the scenes that have very specific camera ideas, those ideas started in the script. And that's because I'm not fast, I'm super slow. And part of why I'm slow is I'm trying to find that thing I'm connecting to. And I've said this like a bunch of times when people ask me about the writing process and the creative process. For me, I feel like when you start with the blank page, it's kind of like being in a totally dark room on your hands and knees, and you're just crawling around until you get your hands on something. And so when this idea of starting in the Riddler's point of view came to me, I thought, oh, this is interesting. I also thought there was something, which I have to admit, appealed to me, slightly perverse about it, because I thought, wow,
oh, yeah,
every other superhero movie is going to begin with an action sequence. That's just what it's going to be. So I thought, so to play out this long shot through the binoculars and have the big title, I mean, that was in the script too. It was like, it said, you know, big red letters full screen, the Batman. And then you go in on the binoculars, and I thought, oh, so the message of that subliminally is this the Batman's point of view? Who's breathing? What are we doing? And then that was one of those early ideas where I thought, oh, there's a dialogue between what the Riddler's doing and what Batman's doing, and there's a comparison being made. And so that beginning scene was really the birth of that. And then the Ave Maria, which was always in the script, that idea didn't come to me until we were in editing. And then I was like, hey, I knew that Paul had done this beautiful moment where he's singing the song. That was script.
Oh, I see. So this, you added it after he had been.
I added it because I was like, there were many places where Ave Maria was scripted, and we did do it. It was like at the mayor's memorial, and we had that. But then I just felt like, to me, it was really important that when he sang it, that it felt absolutely inevitable, that it felt like from the very beginning of this movie, it was all leading to this moment where he was going to start taunting Batman by singing Ave Maria. And so somewhere in there, the original music that was temped in there was all kind of suspense music, and it was some Michael stuff and that kind of stuff. And I was like, I don't know why, but what if we just start this? I mean, I did know why. It was because of the idea, but it was just like this thing where we just tried it, and we were like, oh, that's unexpected. So it continued to actually fulfill this idea of slight perversity, which was to take a scene that would never, ever start. The idea that a big title just pops on. We don't have a big title sequence. We don't have anything. We just have the logos. I had to go to them. I said, listen, can we do a thing and not have the DC big sort of logo? Can I not have the water tower? Can we just have logo, black, the Batman, and then Ave Maria plays, and the audience are probably going like, what are you doing? And so it was like, you know, the audience is probably like, you're out of your mind, and I'm out.
Well, it throws you into the head of the Riddler, just as, I mean, later there's a kind of a voyeuristic scene of Batman watching. It almost reminded me of a little De Palma-esque creepy watching these people. But also,
which all comes from, by the way, of course,
Hitchcock. Yeah, of course. So I mean, that's what, when I think of your films, over the years, it's all about perspective. And it's one of the things I think you do really, really well, which is put us, I mean, you think about Cloverfield. I mean, the reason that movie works is the unique perspective. You think about Let Me In, and we're kind of in these dueling perspectives of a child and in a killer, like this like monster. And in this film, I think what, for me, what really jumped out from the beginning is, while we've had Batman stories and some of them have, yes, as you said, you get kind of enamored with the villains, maybe too much. You're really more in the head of Batman than you've ever been. And that's literally being taking his POV at times. It's also some narration in the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, the Gotham Project, his diaries. Was that ever? I mean, it's by and large, it's the beginning, beginning 30 minutes. We hear more of that. And then it comes back at the end. Was there a temptation to weave that through the entire film at any point? Or was it always setting
that was
it up
something
and then
at the writing stage? That I think when I first started, I thought maybe, you know, I think there was part of me that was thinking, you know, there were kind of two things that inspired that in weird paths that I arrived at them at. But one of them was the idea, because I was very interested in the idea of what it meant psychologically to be Batman and the idea of putting on this mask night after night. It made me think of Jekyll and Hyde. And the idea of the way Dr. Jekyll keeps this book is in the form of this sort of charting of the experiment of that he's, you know, that he's doing on himself and the effects of it. And I thought, oh, that'd be interesting if we had this kind of diary. And then it also made me think of Travis Bickle and how Travis Bickle is trying to kind of find his way in a way that obviously is much even in sort of lost in the mystery of even less self-knowledge, I would say, than Bruce is. But all of that kind of, that came from year one. In looking at year one, I did a deep dive in the comics. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the comics have narration in them, right? I mean, that's kind of how you do it. And so that idea of trying to feel like it's true to the comics, and specifically this idea of the kind of Travis Bickle thing, came to me because of the year one, you're in Gordon's narration, right, and you're in Batman's narration, which is pretty cool. I mean, so I really loved, I just, oh, this is all really, really interesting to get into their heads in this way and to feel it like it's almost like a diary, almost journalistic. I just love that. And then there's actually a moment in the comic where Bruce, before he's Batman, goes to the East End and he puts a scar on his face and he needs another disguise because he's not Batman yet. And he also, though, can't go as Bruce Wayne because people will recognize Bruce Wayne. So he puts on what looks like a kind of army jacket that looks like it could be Travis Bickle's. And I had the commemorative edition and I was going through the drawings and then I was going through the stuff at the end. And there's a bunch of notes where when Frank Miller was writing his notes to Mazzucchelli for what to draw, he said, in this panel, it looks like Bruce has won the Travis Bickle lookalike contest. And so I was like, oh yeah, okay. So this, I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. The Martin Scorsese's movies made me want to be a director, you know? And so I just connected to that idea that, oh, we could make this like a gothic noir that's like Taxi Driver in a way, but also like French Connection. Like there was a kind of, I guess there was something in the vibe of year one that connected to me to a vibe of filmmaking that seemed like a really great way to approach the filmmaking of a neo-noir Batman. And so in it, there was all that narration. So when I started, anyway, this is the longest answer ever.
No, it's all great, yeah.
But when I was writing, I think initially I did think, oh yeah, and maybe this narration follows us through the whole movie. And then I realized that there's a point at which, as I was writing, it was important to get into his mind to understand where we were and to understand what his mindset is. And it was really important to check in again at the end so that you could track this evolution. That was super important. But I realized at a certain point, and it's funny, even when I went back and looked at Taxi Driver again, and there is definitely much more narration than there is in our film. However, even Taxi Driver doesn't keep it up the whole time. There's a distancing effect, I think, if you do it too much. And so once he gets involved in the narrative, I kind of felt like, oh yeah. And I kind of stripped, I think there might've been a point somewhere in there where I might've had one other line or one other section. And I just, at the script stage, took it out. It just was never. So there was never a temptation to keep it going through the cut, because it was one of these things that had sort of been excised even in the kind of planning stages during the script.
Is there, for something like this, you know, you talk about kind of falling in love. I mean, you know, as a kid, falling in love with Batman and seeing cognizant when you kind of take this on of like how much real estate there is in this world and how every nook and cranny of Gotham is fascinating. Do you create like a Bat Bible in a way? Like when you like, I mean, do you create like the backstory of your particular Alfred and Oz, et cetera? Like, are there documents that kind of flesh out the rest of this world that are useful for you?
There is, but I would say that it's closer to Bruce's journal, which is that I write in an unlined sketchbook and I just keep writing ideas. If you were to take that and literally transcribe it, it would be it would look like I was insane, because it doesn't hold together as a narrative. It's just a collection. It's kind of like, it's like the place where you put stuff as you're on your hands and knees. And what I often find, or not often find, it is the process for me, is that I come up with an idea. I have to have my notebook and the pens, you know, stuck in the binding, and then you rip it out and you write it down as if, oh, this is, I got to keep track of this idea. You know, the ideas are, there was a book I remember I read during the pandemic from David Lynch, where he talks about the creative process, and it's like fishing, you know, fishing for ideas and things. But there is something to that, right? You use your conscious mind to establish the search, and the subconscious, these ideas sort of emerge, and they're the things that are kind of emerged that mean something to you. So you're searching for meaning, right? So I have an idea and I'll write it down, and I keep thinking, that's an important one. And then what I do is, at a certain point after I've been doing this for a while, I'll go back and I'll look and I'll see that something that I've written down as if it was the first time, I've written down like 5-6 times. And then I'm like, oh, important idea.
Something there, yep.
Yeah, and so then it starts forming that way, but this notebook just keeps getting filled in, and I will, you know, I have ideas will come about people's backstories, and, you know, I was doing a lot of reading of comics and things that would appeal to me in the comics. I'd kind of just write a piece of that idea down as an inspiration for something that could be taken and sort of turned and transformed. And so in a weird kind of sprawling way, and this one in particular, because the story is the story of the history of Gotham, which, you know, at many points I thought, why did I do that? But I know why I did it. I mean, it's sort of like, well, if you're going to do a story that isn't an origin tale, you want to be definitive, right? Anyway, so this is a good entry point, that these crimes are describing a history of corruption in a place. Like, that's a great sort of noir kind of conceit if you can land it.
Yep.
And yet it meant that so much of what was happening, that there was violence happening in the present that needed to be stopped, but it was referring to corruption that had been ongoing in the past. And so there was a tremendous amount of backstory that had to be worked out, and then figuring out how to do that. It's one of those things where if I knew how hard it was going to be from the beginning, I don't think I would have done it exactly in that way again. But you always do, you know.
Do any of the ideas, because I know there's obviously a bunch of other ideas, and you know, you need this, we want this movie to succeed, but there are plans for this Gotham PD show, and I know you talked about an Arkham show, et cetera, and the Penguin. Are there any that involve that history of Gotham? Are there any that would go backwards?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, one thing that we're not doing that I was going to do, so there's the Gotham police show, which where it's that one actually is put on hold. We're not really doing that. We're doing a story about my idea for that gave birth to the Penguin series. Is I was talking about the show that we were doing with HBO Max with the executives at HBO Max, and I said, you know, they said, you know, we want to dig deeply into areas that maybe wouldn't traditionally have been in the streaming space, off of the idea that you're also trying to do something in the theatrical world that is, you know, sort of serving this, you're trying to do a trilogy or whatever it is, who knows, whatever it is. But, and so I said, well, and they said, we don't want you to take the characters that are precious to you and save them for just the movies. There has to be, you know, we really encourage you to. And I was like, well, I said, I did, you know, the whole idea for me, because Oz, the Penguin in the story, he's a little bit of a red herring. He starts in one way and then you realize that he's, and the reason that I chose him for that is because I thought, oh, that's a big enough name that if you're looking for who the informant is, it would make sense that it would be somebody who is that iconic. Maybe this is that version of this character. And so that's kind of how that was calibrated. And then I thought, well, to me, the fun of that conception is that he is not fully formed yet, and that that he's not yet become the kingpin. And that I thought that there was a story in the wake of what happens at the end of this story, where there's a power vacuum, and you've got all of these. And that's why right now you see Oz at the end of the movie looking out over the city, standing in Falcone's office and thinking, okay, because the idea there was that he has been underestimated by everyone, but he knows. And so I said, you know, I kind of see like an American Dream Scarface Gotham story, like a guy who nobody, like Tony Montana, no one thinks this guy could be anything. And he has a brutal desire to prove everyone wrong. Like if it's like Fredo meets Tony Soprano or something, you know? And I said, you know, and I just think that there's a way to see that character and see all of, again, get into in a novelistic way, which is to me what's exciting about long form is, you know, when you're telling a movie story, you're trying to come up with the story within the framework of the film that refers to the past and it implies a future, but this is the current part of it, or not the current part of it, but the critical part of it to see, to understand what that story means, right? That's the whole thing. When you're trying to do long form, what you're trying to do is chapter one of a very long story, with the idea being that each of these chapters, you're revisiting things about this character. And, you know, in total, in the aggregate of all of it, it's the epic story of this character, but it's very novelistic. There are so many stories to tell, and each of those stories tells this larger story. Whereas when you're trying to tell a movie, you're trying to tell the one larger story.
Yep.
So what excited me about doing a Penguin story, especially since the idea was that here was this guy who was so underestimated and had all of these sort of desires to sort of make up for the wounds of his life, that I thought, wow, there's a, you know, and especially the way Colin played him, I just thought that was really exciting. So they got very excited and said, we'll do that show, like on that phone call. I said, oh, great.
It should all be so easy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they said, we're doing that show. I was like, okay. Because we were talking about the GCPD show, and they were saying like, look, this isn't squarely into the characters that we think that we know, you know, because I had this whole idea that was kind of like, sort of like Prince of the City. And I wanted,
Sidney Lumet kind of thing. Yeah.
It was a Sidney Lumet thing. And what I wanted to do was the series was going to be kind of like Prince of the City, where it was going to be year one, like because the movie is year two. And I wanted it to be the first appearance, but it wasn't going to be a Batman story. It was going to be about this corrupt cop. And it was going to be about how the worst gang in Gotham were the GCPD. And he was going to come across paths. He would have touched paths, you know, with Gordon, who would have been, you know, he would have been someone to measure him against, but it would be a battle for his soul. Right. And the idea is that the appearance of this character. Now, I love this idea.
I love what you're talking about. I'm so in.
It's super cool to me. And they didn't not like the idea. They just wanted it to be, they wanted to center a show on a character who was more, I get it.
You know, no, I get
just
it.
Yep. Something. And so I was like, okay, so maybe that someday we'll do that show. Okay. Who knows? But in any case, this show became that show. And there's another show that we're talking about off of the movie too. But so
the Arkham thing, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. In order to come up with all of the characters' stories, there's a tremendous amount of backstory that you have to get into. And then obviously the idea is that this story, look, I never wanted to tell a story, certainly not a movie story, that was meant to be chapter one.
Right.
Because you never know if you're going to get a chance to do another one. So you have to swing for the fences and say, this is my chance. This might be it. This is the one. So if this is it, I'm going to lay it on the table. So warts and all, it may work, it may not, but this was my attempt to do this story. And the only thing about a Batman story, though, is no matter where it ends, it doesn't really end with Batman's story being over, because that means that the world doesn't need Batman. And of course the world needs Batman, because, and that's to me what was exciting about this story as well, is that Gotham is such a lens on our world. And there's never a time when crime and corruption is out of vogue, sadly. And there are the ebbs and flows, and there's times when crime is at an all-time low, but it isn't gone, and it's always swinging back because that's human nature. And that is one of the, you know, that's our struggle to live with each other, to live in this world. And unfortunately, I would say even over the course of just making this movie, given that I started in 2017 and here we are, it's coming out 5 years later, things sort of bubbled up in the world that in many ways are closer to the vision of Gotham than I ever intended.
Yep.
And in certain moments while we're making the movie, you know, after the pandemic hit and we found a way to go back, there were moments where, you know, we kind of looked at each other as we're making the movie going, oh my God, like the whole point was to sort of show a heightened level of corruption. And yet there are moments now where you look at the world around us and you go, is the world worse than Gotham? And so,
giving a run for its money, I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. It's giving its run. So anyway, so the point is that story at the end, I always knew, you know, especially because of where it was leaving him with Selena, you couldn't look at that story and go like, yeah, go ahead, go with her. It's fine. That's the story.
No. His story is just beginning, though. It feels, yes, there's the distinct arc from vengeance to hope, as is illuminated by seeing it twice. Talk to me a little bit about
that. Once I got into the story, that was the early concept. That was one of the hands and knees idea, because in looking at all of the vengeance stuff, you know, I knew I didn't want him to say I'm Batman. That had been done really well. And looking at the comics and the animated series and the Conroy thing, you know, where, you know, I'm vengeance, I am the night. And I was like, oh, I'm vengeance. That's cool. And then that just sparked this idea because of trying to see him sort of being consumed by his shadow side and yet not yet having incorporated that enough to understand how much of what is driving him is personal. And is that even the right path? You know, is being a vigilante the right path? Taking the law into your right hand, into your own hands, and the idea of vengeance, is that being your prime motivator? That's a really dark question. Is that really the right path? And so I felt like that idea of trying to find him in the early days of being on an arc from being squarely rooted in vengeance to the beginnings of understanding he has to be more, and he has to represent hope to people so that they don't feel desperate in this place. That was one of the very early ideas.
Matt, we can't do a spoiler talk without talking about the Joker. So, you know,
who's that?
Well, there's this guy named Barry Keoghan, a very talented actor, that shows up at the very end of this film. We get enough of a glimpse of him. We hear a bit of a laugh. When did that idea emerge that Barry was your guy and that you wanted to plant the seeds of this larger world and this other iconic character?
You know, it's not what people think based on the way that it's currently represented in the movie, because the way that character, once I knew that I wasn't doing an origin story, but I wanted to do an early years Batman, and in all the comics, and when you read it, there's a lot of Rogues Gallery Genesis stories that come in response to the fact that there is a masked vigilante declaring himself or being called the Batman in Gotham. And so they're kind of a response. And so I thought, oh, well, actually, given how early this is, that we're entering the second year of the Gotham project, that it would mean that their stories are in their origins. And so I thought it would be interesting. I like the idea of having a Gotham that felt like it already pre-existed. And this guy was going down the streets, and if you turned down the wrong alley, you would meet somebody in their sort of genesis stages of that. And somewhere along the way, once it became this serial killer story about the Riddler leaving messages to Batman with the idea that Batman's only power is in being anonymous and being this kind of apparition that he's trying to create, this phantom. And so when somebody starts shining the light on him by writing to him, it's very unnerving. Like, don't call me Batman. I call myself Batman. I call myself Vengeance, right? Yeah. And so I thought, well, he would be so unsettled by that and unsettled by the crimes and would feel that he would need to get into that mindset, that psychological mindset, so that he would try to profile the character. And so there was a scene, which we shot, which is actually very cool, which I'm sure we'll release as a, it's one of the, it's not a short film, so this is one of the few deleted scenes. But it didn't. In the overall, it wasn't necessary, and in fact, it was important to keep the story going. And there wasn't anything in this scene that narratively and thematically wasn't happening in the overall, because it was all about how he went to Arkham, and there was this character whose face was out of focus the whole time. You're focused on that glass, and you're seeing. And Mike Marino did this incredible makeup, where I told him, okay, so you've got the bokeh, the out of focus bokeh of these lenses to sketch in Conrad Veidt. You have the man who laughs, like the idea of doing that kind of thing. And the idea is that he's going to this guy who somehow you get, he says to him at the beginning of the scene, he says, it's almost your anniversary, isn't it? And you realize, oh, Batman has something to do with this guy being in jail. And he's obviously a killer as well. And the idea is that he is the character you're referring to, but has not yet declared himself that. It's the early days of this, and they already have this kind of connection. And he has an insidious understanding of psychology. And so Batman is resisting. He's like going, well, what are you afraid that this guy makes you look weak? I mean, you're so similar. You're masked Avengers. You think he's more righteous than you. Is that it? You think he makes you look soft. And he's like, I'm not here to talk about me. And it's this whole thing where there's a kind of psychological battle of wills as Batman is there to see if he can get any clues as to why this guy's writing to him and what he might do next. And the Joker actually ends up being completely right about the journey of the movie is interesting. So probably another reason why we ended up not needing it in the movie.
He's your Hannibal Lecter expert.
He's very Lecter-like. I read Mindhunter.
Yeah.
And that whole idea of getting into that thing. So that's what that was. And then the final scene of the movie was a kind of payoff to that scene. So the idea is that the Riddler, it was that final scene of that movie is really to track Paul's sort of where he ends up in the movie, where he's devastated. And Paul is so delightful in that scene with Barry. And Barry's great with him. And Barry, by the way, I'm really excited to share this scene because Barry, who's a wonderful actor, what he and Rob did in that scene that we cut is really interesting and cool. It's creepy and eerie and psychological. And the makeup that Mike did is very, very cool. We talked about that. I said, you know, I wanted an origin tale that went back to the Conrad Veidt idea, which meant I didn't want, you know, Nolan had done this really fantastic thing with the scars and what is the origin of the scars and the unreliable answers that he's giving. And you're just like, oh my God, this is just, which was amazing. And of course you'd had other iterations. You have the classic ones where, you know, he falls into the vat of chemicals. You have the Nicholson thing. So you have all these things that have been in the comics. And I thought, well, I'd love to do something that's like The Man Who Laughs, which is not a horror film, but it's kind of like Phantom of the Opera, which is where the original Bob Kane, Bill Finger version of the character comes from, which is this guy has a kind of congenital disease where he can't stop smiling and how horrifying that would be. And so I thought, oh, well, here's an interesting origin. What if he's essentially like the Elephant Man in that he's born with a degenerative disease that has disfigured him so terribly. And instead of becoming like John Merrick, or at least John Merrick, as we know from the beautiful film by David Lynch, who has this beautiful soul within this exterior that is so horrifying. If instead he felt that the fates had played a kind of nihilistic joke on him by making him a freak from birth, and that would make him attuned to, like, basically being able to get into the minds of people who looked at him with terror because they from childhood he's used to that look, and so he has this look at humanity which is very dark and informed by this disease that he had no control over, and so he was marked from the beginning to become what he becomes, and he had not yet declared himself the Joker that he'd do that in this thing. So that's what Mike and I talked about, and Mike was like, Mike is a genius, and he was like, he loved the idea of Elephant Man and suddenly started sculpting and started doing all of this incredible stuff. Mike did the stuff for Colin, for Penguin. I mean, he's an incredible prosthetics makeup artist, and he's a wonderful sculptor, and so he did all of that, and so that scene was really fun to do. And then at the end of the movie I did briefly try taking it out, and I noticed that when I took that scene out that the stakes of the final scene between Selina and Batman changed entirely, because the whole idea of that scene is that she's saying, you know, this place is never going to change. And then he's saying, like, I have to try. And if you don't feel the menace of what's coming, not necessarily in another movie, but just in the power vacuum, then it kind of feels cerebral and not emotional. And so you know that Batman is fated. He's sort of, his personal scars make him perfectly suited to being this character. And so, you know, as much as, you know, we'd all like to think, oh, well, just go off and be happy, that's not going to make us happy, because we want him to continue to do what he's going to do. And so when I took that scene out, the ending didn't play as well. So this is a long way of saying that that was, yes, you're correct, that is the character who it is, and it is meant to refer to his origins. And there absolutely are ideas that I have about doing something with that character, but it's not meant as a kind of classic superhero Easter egg movie moment where it's kind of like, oh, well, that's the next movie, huh?
Right.
I'm not saying that's the next movie at all. Not even slightly.
Last thing for you. I know you know you have to run, but the one aspect of Batman in the comics, I feel like that's never been cracked really well in the films, with all due respect to Joel Schumacher and Chris O'Donnell, is Robin. Can Robin exist in your universe? Can a teenage boy or girl kind of work in this horrible Gotham that you have created, this pit of despair? I mean that in the nicest possible way, but it's a harrowing idea to see a teenager in that world.
Maybe. I'll just say maybe. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. Here's the thing. I have a lot of ideas about what I want to do. I'm not sure what the next story is, but the whole Colin Penguin story was born of the fact that there were things that I saw in this moment, and I definitely want to take on this moment of how this is a power vacuum. But I'm not sure exactly where the point of entry is going to be. And I do look, you know, when I was a kid, as I said, Adam West was my Batman and Burt Ward was my Robin. So obviously the tone of that, I didn't see any of the camp in that. I just thought it was, I don't know, I was just so drawn to those guys doing what they were doing and driving that car and having all those gadgets. And I think, you know, now the idea is obviously trying to think about whether or not there's something interesting to do as a filmmaker with that. And I think, look, the notion of, here's the thing. For me, whatever that story is going to be, it's going to be to take these characters, and specifically Batman's character, and put them in some kind of emotional jeopardy. So when you talk about what you're talking about, there may be a really interesting story to put, you know, there have to be emotional stakes so that you get drawn into that character story. I don't want that character to become a cipher. I don't want to be like, okay, so we saw it wasn't an origin tale, but you know what? That was kind of his origins. And now he's just perfect. Like, no, you need to test the character again and again and again. And for me, yeah, there might be something in that. I don't know. I'm going to, you know, there's a deep dive that already happened at the beginning. And now I'm going to have to deep dive again if we have the chance to make another one. And so we shall see.
I hope you get the chance, man. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you. As you can tell, I'm a big fan of this one. And there is a lot to be explored. So hopefully the audiences will come out and support it. Certainly the critics are loving this one. Enjoy the moment. I'm sorry we weren't able to enjoy the premiere, but hopefully you're feeling the love for this, man. And hopefully we can chat again soon.
Oh, thanks, man. I look forward to it.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
3 to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.